right, good evening, everybody. It's about 7 o'clock, so we'll go ahead and get started here. My name is Zachary Weber. I'm the Education Coordinator of Adult Programs here at Carnegie Science Center. I'd like to welcome you to Café Scientifique. Our speaker tonight is Michael Goff. Michael Goff has his PhD from Brown University in biology and was a professor at the Baylor College of Medicine in the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He was a program manager at the Office of Technology Assessment, United States Congress, served on and chaired national committees dealing with various risk assessment controversies in the White House, at the Department of Health and Human Services, and the Department of Veteran Affairs. He published many papers in basic science, technology assessment, and health risk assessment in technical journals. Since his retirement, he has volunteered at the Aviation Museums and as a teacher of English as a second language. He has written many articles about airplane racing in the 1910s and 20s, which leads to his current book, The Pulitzer Air Races, American Aviation in Speed Supremacy, which was published last May, and which brings him here tonight. So please join me in welcoming Michael Goff.
I want to thank the Carnegie Science Center for the invitation to come and talk. And I also want to thank you for coming out on a wintry evening to hear me talk about some air races that took place in this country about 90 years ago, which live in obscurity, and which I consider to be the most important events in American aviation between 1917 and Lindbergh's flight in 1927. 90 and 100 years ago, air racing was very important in aviation. Designers and engineers and manufacturers would produce a new airplane, and the way they'd sell it to the public was to take it to an air meet, and then enter it into a contest to fly the highest, fly the farthest, or fly the fastest. And the attraction at every air meet was the races for speed. And so I'm going to be talking about the Pulitzer Air Races, which were held in this country, and I'm going to emphasize the race in Detroit in 1922 and the race in St. Louis in 1923. In the first third of the 20th century, there were three great air races. The Gordon Bennett Trophy Races, which was for land planes, and it was international. French, British, United States, all flew in the Gordon Bennett races. The second one I want to briefly mention is the Schneider Trophy Races, which was for seaplanes. And the Schneiders were flown from 1913 to 1931, not every year, but for that long period of time. And they, too, were international. The United States won two Schneider races, 1923 and 25. And then the final race set of races is the Pulitzer Trophy Races for land planes, which was entirely a domestic U.S. affair. Great efforts were made to bring European pilots and airplanes to the United States to fly in the Pulitzers. And a lot of money was spent on trying to entice them, but they didn't come. So it was purely a United States affair. I'm going to mention quickly the characteristics of these races. The Gordon Bennetts were a race for a trophy and cash prize donated by a man named James Gordon Bennett, Jr., who was the owner, publisher, and editor of the New York Herald. He was a very successful newspaper man. He's the one who sent Henry Morgan to Africa to find Dr. Livingston. So we have the immortal words of Dr. Livingston, I presume. And he was a very successful newspaper man, disreputable a lot of times because he was a drunk. In the last decade of the 19th century, the first decade of the 20th century, he took $30 million from the profits of the New York Herald and invested a lot of it in trophies for sporting contests. He offered trophy for bicycle racing and trophies for rugby and trophies for this and that. He offered a trophy for the first automobile race, which was raced six times from 1899 through 1905. And in 1905, he pulled the plug on sponsoring automobile races because they'd become too commercial. And I think he was fighting a rising tide, because if you look at a NASCAR race or a Formula One race now, every inch of the car and every inch of the uniform of the driver is covered with advertising logos. So maybe Bennett was onto that a long time before it happened. The most long-lasting of his trophies is for a balloon race. This balloon race has been going on, not annually, but very nearly annually, for 110 years. And it's not a race, it's a distance contest. People take their balloons, and they go to a specific place, they take off on a specific day, and the winner is the crew that drifts the farthest. I don't have time to talk about that. If you go to your computer and look up Gordon Bennett balloon races, you learn a lot about those races, and there's some very beautiful pictures of the balloons. The race that interests me, of course, is the airplane race, which was flown six times from 1909 through 1913, suspended during the World War, and flown again in 1920. When Gordon Bennett offered the trophy for the airplane race in 1906, he had no idea what kind of contest he wanted. So he went to the Federation, the International Aviation Federation is in English. It's a French name, and I can't pronounce French, but it's the French word is Federation Aviation International. He went to the FAI, and they said, okay, why don't you have a closed course race, which means the planes take off from an airport, they fly around pylons or church steeples or haystacks and make a circuit and make a number of circuits. And so that was the agreement. He would sponsor a closed course race. And the first one was flown in 1909. It was won by Glenn Curtis, an American, flying an airplane that he had designed. It's the last time an American won, well, it's not true, it's the last time an American airplane won the Gordon Bennett. And there were very simple rules. Each aero club, like the Aero Club of America, which is a precursor of the National Aeronautic Association, Aero Club of France, the Royal Aero Club, could enter three racers and three alternatives in each annual race. And the country, or the club that won three races in a row, retired the trophy. So when France won in 1912, in a race that was flown in Chicago, they won in 1913 in a race that was flown in France, and they won again in 1920 in a race that was flown in France, the trophy was retired. The Schneiders, this was a trophy and cash prize offered by Jacques Schneider, who was a member of a very wealthy French armaments manufacturing company. The rules were similar to the Gordon Bennett. In fact, they're patterned very closely to it. The winning aero club hosted the next year's meeting, next year's race, and the first aero club to win three times in a row retired the trophy. It was flown 13 times from 1913 to 1931. And to show you the importance of racing in the development of modern airplanes, this is the airplane that won the 1931 Schneider Trophy. It's a Supermarine S6B. It flew 340 miles an hour on a closed circuit course. Later on, it was the first airplane to fly faster than 400 miles per hour in level flight, despite these monstrous pontoons it was carrying around. So it was a very fast airplane, and it's not so apparent from this view. It is apparent on other views. This plane looks very much like the Supermarine Spitfire, which was the primary fighter plane for the RAF in World War II. And equally significantly, the Rolls-Royce engine that powered this racer was sort of the progenitor of the Rolls-Royce Merlins and Griffins that powered the warplanes in Great Britain during World War II. So the Schneider particularly has a very direct influence on airplane design. And this is the man for whom the Pulitzer Trophy was named, Joseph Pulitzer, who's the publisher of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and of the New York World. And he lived a very adventuresome life. He was born in Hungary to a large family. There were seven or eight children. And he was born in middle class. The father died. The family was plunged into poverty. He could not find a job in Hungary. He went to Hamburg, Germany during the American Civil War. and enlisted in the Union Army because there were agents in Hamburg that would enlist him in arrange for his enlistment in the U.S. Army, and in return they would pay his passage across the ocean, and when they got to Boston and he collected his enlistment bonus, the agent would take a large part of it. Well, Pulitzer, and I expect a lot of other men who came with him, when the ship got into Boston Harbor, he jumped ship, neither swam ashore or waded ashore, stories differ, avoided the agent, went to New York City, enlisted in the Army, got all of his bonus. He served in a New York cavalry regiment, which was entirely German-speaking. There was no English spoken in that regiment during the Civil War. He fought in some skirmishes in Maryland, or at least his unit fought in some skirmishes in Maryland. The war was over. He was an unemployed veteran. He was desperate for work. And a friend of his said, go to St. Louis, Missouri. There are not many Germans there. There's only a lot of prejudice. You really fit in, because you'll be unusual. You'll be a German. St. Louis was teeming with Germans. Half the population was German. And he broke into, go back to his picture, he broke into journalism on a German language newspaper. He learned English, became active in politics, was elected to the Missouri State Legislature, and then he got into English, publishing English papers. And he purchased two papers, the Post and the Dispatch, and combined them with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which was a very successful newspaper. It's not now. It's a tabloid with very little advertising, and it's on its last legs. But it was a great newspaper for a long time. Then he bought the New York World from Jay Gould. He was a very successful newspaper man. He was not an altogether pleasant man. He probably never spoke to his youngest son, because his youngest son was noisy. And as an old man, his ears became very sensitive to noise, and he lived in essentially a soundproof yacht in a soundproof house and then soundproof offices. But he died in 1911. 5 years later, his three sons decided to offer a trophy for the fastest annual transcontinental airplane flight. And they also decided that they would wait till after the war to fly the first contest. So in 1919, the Pulitzers were ready to stage their first transcontinental contest, but the Army beat them to it. The Army organized a race, which was a very big race, 56 airplanes. Some of them took off from the Presidio in San Francisco. Some of them took off from Mitchell Field on Long Island. They flew all the way across the country. They flew all the way back, and that was the race. And my gestures are completely misleading. Now, if you fly from Long Island to San Francisco, it's just one big airplane flight. 1920, you'd take off, or 1919, you'd take off, and you'd fly maybe 190 miles, which was as far as your airplane would go. And you would land, add some gas, add some oil, add some water, probably repair the thing because it was shaking itself off to death. And but anyway, so it would take you 15 or 20 hops to get across the country and 15 or 20 hops to get back. The Air Service staged this to bring publicity for the Air Service, and it backfired because there were 10 deaths, 10 pilots and the mechanics died in the race, which gave the Pulitzers, weren't sure they wanted to sponsor a race because there was a big risk of death. And even more pointedly for the Pulitzers, they did stage a contest in 1916 for the farthest one-day cross-country flight from an aviation meeting in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And an ex-RAF pilot who was very popular took off and flew to a little town in Massachusetts, which was far enough to win. Nobody else flew farther than that. And on the next day, he flew back to Atlantic City, and he disappeared. Neither he nor his airplane has ever been found, totally lost. So the Pulitzers decided to get away from cross-country races because of the dangers, and they decided to change it to a closed course race. And the first Pulitzer was held on Thanksgiving Day, 1920, 2 months after the last Gordon Bennett. Nobody before, nobody since, and nobody ever will see an airplane race like the 1920 Pulitzer race. There were 44 entrants. They were divided into seven flights so that airplanes of comparable speeds would fly against each other. 36 of those airplanes took off. For a short period of time, all 36 were in the air. And it must have been very exciting to watch because it was a typical day on Long Island, a wintry day on Long Island. If you've lived there, you'll be familiar with the fact you walk outside and you look up and there's this gray, solid mass of clouds. And it looks like if you stretched up a little bit, you could touch those clouds. So there wasn't a lot of volume for the racers to fly in. They flew from 50 feet above the ground to 300 or 400 feet above the ground. And all these airplanes speeding around for a total of 116 miles. 24 of them finished. And the winner was this rather conventional-looking airplane that had been built for the Army as a fighter. And it was too heavy. It was too big to be a fighter. And General Billy Mitchell said, well, let's make it into a racer. So they got this huge Packard engine, which generated about almost 600 horsepower. And this was a day, this in the day when 300 horsepower was a big engine. And with this big engine, the airplane flew, it won the first Pulitzer race at 156 miles per hour, which is a respectable speed. The second place plane was an ordinary Army pursuit plane or fighter plane, 300 horsepower, and it finished at 152 miles per hour. So this was a winner, but it wasn't a very great, it wasn't a great airplane. Okay. The second race was held in Omaha, Nebraska. And it wasn't planned to be in Omaha, it was planned to be in Detroit. In 1921, the most economically advanced, most bustling city in the United States was Detroit. The population of Detroit went up tenfold in a decade, that decade. And Detroit certainly was established in the automobile industry, and it wanted to become established in the aeronautics industry, airplane industry. So it said, well, we'll sponsor the Pulitzer race. And arrangements went ahead. And then at the beginning of the summer, the government said, we can't afford to send our racers to an air race. So you're on your own. And the leaders of the Detroit aviation community said, well, without the government airplanes, which are very fast, or which can be very fast, we'd have really dull races. We wouldn't have much participation. It'd be a failure. And they reneged. They just backed out. And in August, the real heroes of 1921 emerged. The city of Omaha and the Aero Club of Omaha. Yeah, it's the same place that Peyton Manning yelled about 4 weeks ago, Omaha. But it's not so funny now after yesterday's debacle. But in 3 months, Omaha and the Omaha Aero Club arranged financing for this air meet. They put out all the necessary forms to get people sent to enter the air meet. They built an airport to handle these high-performance airplanes. And the race was held on November the 3rd, and thankfully, it didn't snow. It was chilly, but it didn't snow. In the meantime, the Army and the Navy had decided, well, we can't afford to fly the airplanes that we purchased for the 1921 Pulitzer race. We'll loan them back to the companies that made them. So the Curtis Company had made some racers, and they were loaned back. Other companies made racers, and they were loaned back. So the very fast airplanes were present at Omaha, and the race was held. And the race came down to a contest between two Curtis racing planes, the Cactus Kitten, which was a triplane, and the Curtis Racer, the CR, which was a biplane. And the origin of all of these Curtis planes, Curtis engines and Curtis airplanes dominated the Pulitzers. They also dominated the Schneider races in the 1920s. And they all had their origins in this airplane, which is called a Curtis 18T. In 1917, Charles Kirkham, who was an engineer, developed a V12 engine, two banks of six cylinders, very small frontal area, very lightweight, and it generated 400 horsepower quite easily, when the Wright engines that most people were using could barely generate 300 and were shaking themselves to pieces when stressed like that. And the Curtis engine, or the Kirkham engine, was very smooth, and it didn't shake itself to pieces. So it's a great engine, and Kirkham, who was clearly not a modest man, looked around for an airplane that was good enough for his new engine. And there wasn't one. In the whole world, there wasn't an airplane he considered good enough for his new engine. So he built two airplanes. This is a Curtis 18T, which is a triplane. He also built a Curtis 18B, which was a biplane. The triplane is a more interesting airplane. It was built as a two-seat fighter. The pilot was here, and the gunner observer was back here. And in 1918, with a full load of pilot and observer, three machine guns, and the ammunition of the machine guns, oil and gas and water, it flew 163 miles per hour, which is the fastest airplane in the world, which was really remarkable for that. It wasn't officially timed by the FAI, but it was, I have no doubt, the accuracy of it. It was the fastest airplane in the world. And the important thing about the airplane is this engine, this Curtis V12 engine. For the Gordon Bennett race, the last Gordon Bennett race, the Curtis company built a racer called the Texas Wildcat for a man named S.E.J. Cox, who purchased it. And the Wildcat was built to be flown as a biplane, as it's shown here, or as a monoplane, and there'll be a picture of that later. It was very advanced. It had an enclosed cockpit, had a canopy, just unheard of in 1920. This is a radiator here, and inside was a Curtis V12 engine. And here are three people who were very, here's the Wildcat being flown as a monoplane. Just the lower wing is not attached, it's just being flown as a monoplane. This man is S.E.J. Cox. S.E.J. Cox was a Texas promoter. Promoters lived in Houston, and they all made a fortune because they would buy up land or lease land in Texas, in Oklahoma, places like that. And then they would say that they sent out a geologist, and the geologist had looked at the land, and the land was swelling with oil. And all they needed was a few dollars to build the drilling rigs, and everybody would be a millionaire. And they sold lots and lots of land, and they leased lots and lots of land. And they sold to literally widows and orphans. And very poor people invested in these oil lands and lost their shirts. On the other hand, Cox and his cronies did extremely well. Cox was making $24,000 a week in U.S. in current money, writing advertising copy for other people and drawing a salary of over $250,000 from his own companies. I mean, this is not a lot of money compared to Wall Street, I know, but it's a lot of money compared to the rest of us, I think. So, and in 1920, and Cox and his wife, who, as a historian of the oil fields, described his wife, Nellie, as having the face and the figure of a movie star. They were a very glamorous couple. They both liked airplanes. Mrs. Cox was the first woman to own an airplane in the United States. Seymour used airplanes all the time in his business. And in 1920, the Aero Club of Texas wrote a letter to Seymour and a lot of other people and said, "We're going to build a racer for the 1920 Gordon Bennett race. Would you like to contribute?" And Cox, seeing an opportunity for publicity, wrote back and said, "Don't worry about it, I'll pay for the racers." And he did. So that's this fellow here. These two men are pilots. This is Clarence Coombs, who would fly the Cactus Kitten in 1921. And this is Roland Ross, who flew the Texas Wildcat in France in 1920. And here's the Texas Wildcat monoplane. The Texas Wildcat was flown as a monoplane on Long Island, and then it came time to ship the plane and everything else to France for the Gordon Bennett in 1920. Reportedly, Cox took 100 tons of stuff with him. Two airplanes, tools, spare parts, I don't know what all. They got to France, and they tried to fly the airplane as a monoplane, and they couldn't get it off the ground because the French airfields were much shorter than the airfields on Long Island. In 4 days, they designed new biplane wings and a new tail, and on the day before the last Gordon Bennett, Roland Ross took off in the Texas Wildcat to fly 30 miles to Etampes, which was this French town where the Gordon Bennett was being held. And as he took off, the spectators saw him hit a rut at the end of the takeoff run and bounce into the air. And he felt that too. But he later said, the Wildcat flew better than ever had ever flown. It was a real bear to fly, evidently. It was very difficult to fly. But he made the 30-mile trip to Etampes. He came into land, and the landing gear collapsed. And the landing gear collapsed for more than one reason. It's probably damaged on the takeoff. The spokes, you can't even see the spokes here, but the spokes had been put on the wheels incorrectly. And the main reason probably was that there's no shock absorber, there's no springs anywhere in this airplane. Shock absorbers and springs weigh something. And this airplane was built with the idea there'd be no extra weight of any kind. And so the landing gear was solidly mounted against the wings and on the fuselage. And when the plane landed, the landing gear collapsed, and the airplane turned turtle, knocked the tail off, and left Roland Ross underneath the airplane. Ah, but the French Army had medics there, and they rushed out literally with a bottle of brandy to rescue the pilot, and they did that, and then they helped him with his dislocated shoulder and his injured head. But it was the end of Curtis Cox Wildcat in the Gordon Bennett race. But the important thing was that Curtis had built a racing plane, and they liked it. And they had an engine to power race planes. In 1921, at the race in Omaha, the first of the Curtis race planes appeared. It's called the CR. CR is the imaginative name, the Curtis Racer. It was built for the Navy. The Navy loaned it back to Curtis to be flown in Omaha. Its pilot was a man named Bert Acosta, who is the epitome of the swashbuckling 1920s pilot. He was handsome. He had dark hair and a dark mustache. He wore a long black leather flying jacket. Had an amazing reputation for the ability to charm women. And he was an excellent pilot, just a superb pilot. He also became an alcoholic and died in a tuberculosis ward, which was too bad. But here he is. Here's Bert Acosta. Here's the Curtis CR. Here's the Pulitzer Trophy, which he had won. And there's standing in front of the Curtis factory at Garden City, Long Island, New York. The building is still there. They don't make airplanes inside anymore. They make hanging manila folders for desks. The building's still there, it looks just the same. I want to draw your attention to these structures on the landing gear. This is a radiator. Called a Lamblin radiator, because made by the French company, the Lamblin French company. And this rocket ship projectile here is just for show on the ground, because it was actually hollow. And it was a very efficient radiator, and it didn't cost a lot in wind resistance, which radiators on a lot of early airplanes are just like automobile radiators, so you're pushing this big, flat surface through the air, which slows you down. But the Lamblins were very good. Acosta won the Pulitzer race at Omaha at 177 miles per hour. And his competitor was the Curtis Cox Cactus Kitten, which was a stablemate of the Texas Wildcat. It had been built to be flown as a biplane or a monoplane. In 1922 or 21, it was flown as a triplane. And there were two reasons for that. One is that Curtiss had a lot of triplane wings lying around they didn't know what to do with. And the second was that this plane was very difficult to fly. And the hope was that by putting the three wings on there, it would be easier to fly. Here's the pilot, Clarence Coombs, who's the shorter of the two pilots in the picture with Mr. Cox. Coombs had been associated with the kitten for over a year, but he had never flown it until the race day for the 1921 Pulitzer. He stepped into the cockpit for the first time and took off and flew the race without ever having test flown the airplane. On the straightaways, the course was about 30 miles, a triangular course about 30 miles long, about 11 miles on each side. On the straightaways, the Cactus Kitten was clearly faster. But when the turns came, the Kitten, which was a clumsy plane, flown by a pilot who was inexperienced in it, made very sweeping turns, so adding to the distance he had to fly and slowing down. Whereas the CR, flown by Acosta, who was very familiar with the airplane, banked very closely and made up and got around the corners much quicker. And the difference was the CR won and the Cactus Kitten finished second. So in 1922, Detroit said, okay, the government's back in the races. We'll be happy to host the race. And there was three, and they had a long air meet. It began on a Sunday, and then it was picked up again on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So there were 4 days spread over a week and a day. And there were three main races. The first one is the Curtiss Marine Trophy race, which was a race for seaplanes, which was flown over the Detroit River in downtown Detroit. 200,000 people saw that race, and it was very, very exciting, and I don't have time to talk about it. If you read my book, there's a description of it. The second race was the John L. Mitchell race, which was for a trophy donated by General Billy Mitchell in honor of his brother who had died in France. And this was a race between ordinary Army pursuit planes, fighter planes, flown by ordinary Army pursuit pilots, which sounds pretty boring. It was one of the most exciting air races ever. It ran until 1936. And it was exciting because the planes were easily matched, and it depended on minor differences in piloting skill. There was a lot of weaving and maneuvering and efforts to cut people off and overtake them. Okay. I don't have time to talk about that either. I'm sorry. And the final race in the 1922 National Air Race was the Pulitzer Trophy race, which was a 250-kilometer race. See what you're missing, because I can't talk about the seaplane race. The Pulitzer race was not held in Detroit. Only the Marine Curtiss Trophy race was held down here. It was held at Selfridge Field, which is an Air Service landing field near Mount Clemens, Michigan. And it was flown largely over water because there was concern that the planes, they were all experimental planes, would crash. And it would be better to crash in the water than crash over land where people would be endangered. In the Pulitzer, the Detroit Air Race in 1922 was the first air meet that was called a National Air Race. And National Air Race still continues in various guises. There were 17 entrants. 14 of them started. They flew in three heats. Again, the planes that were matched closely flew against each other. There was one sesquiplane, which you may never have seen that word before, but I'll explain it in a minute. 8 monoplanes, 5 biplanes, 9 finished. The favored competitors were the Wright NW1 sesquiplane and the Curtiss R6 biplane. The Curtiss company and the Wright company hated each other. When the Wright invented the airplane, actually when they invented a glider, and they invented a control system so the glider could be rolled or banked and controlled laterally, they patented that. They patented the mechanism for controlling lateral flight. That patent was applied directly to airplanes. And the Wrights went to court and said, anybody who builds an airplane that can maneuver like this is infringing our patent. And they won every court case. So that when other people tried to build airplanes, like when Curtiss built airplanes, the Wrights sued him. And then Curtiss turned around and tried to counter-sue the Wrights. But the result of the Wright patent wars was that American aviation stood still. The Wrights were so busy in court that they couldn't do anything about developing airplanes. Other manufacturers couldn't even begin to develop airplanes because who would finance an airplane not knowing how much the Wrights are going to charge you for the right to fly? The patent war was finally settled in 1917 when the United States entered World War I. And the British, the Italians, and the French came to us and said, we need you to build airplanes under license. And there were all kinds of conflicts in with the patents. So the government brokered an agreement so that from then on, everybody who, I don't know if it's still true, but I don't know, it's true back then, every time somebody built an airplane, he paid a small license fee to the Wright company and a still smaller license fee to the Curtiss company, because Curtiss has some fundamental patents too. And that ended the Wright patent wars. But Curtiss and Wright had gotten off on the wrong foot. In the 1920s, they were competing for everything. They both wanted to sell airplanes and engines to the government. They both wanted to sell airplanes and engines to commercial firms. And they were really disliked each other. So the race was set up. The 1922 Pulitzer ended up in a race between a Wright airplane and two Curtiss airplanes. Here's a Sesquiplane. A Sesquiplane has a wing and a half. It's a superior wing and the inferior wing. And the Wrights got into racing because they developed a huge engine, a V12, which generated 600 horsepower. And they'd never built, the Wright company hadn't built a racer in years. So they hired a designer who had never designed a racer. And he designed this airplane, which is a Sesquiplane, because a French Sesquiplane had established a world speed record for a short period of time. This was an enormous airplane for a single seat, single engine airplane. Here's an officer leaning against the wheel spat, and his head doesn't even come up to the wing, and it's very heavy. Wingspan's about 30 feet, and it weighed about a little over 3,000 pounds. And here are these Lamblin radiators, which we've seen in the Curtiss race for the last year. Its competitor, this is the Wright plane. It was flown by Lieutenant Sandy Sanderson, who's a Marine Corps lieutenant. This is its competitor, the Wright R6. It's a tiny airplane. It has a wingspan of about 22 feet, weighs at least 1,000 pounds less than the Wright airplane. It has an engine of about 450 horsepower. Smaller than the Wrights, but it's pulling around a much smaller airplane. And you look here, no radiators. The big innovation in 1922 was that Lamblin radiator has been taken off, and the radiator had been, the metal for the radiator had been used to form the airfoil for the wings. And you can't see it in this picture. You'll be able to see it later, the corrugations. So the water left the engine, flowed to the front of the wing, flowed through little channels on top of the wing where it was cooled by the onrush of air, then flowed back on the bottom of the wing to the front of the wing and back to the engine. So it got rid of the radiators, it got rid of that drag, and airplane speeds went way up. And I just think this is a dandy looking little airplane. It looks agile and quick, and it was. And this is a man who won the 1922 Pulitzer race. He's wearing tennis shoes, sneakers. Most of the Curtiss racer pilots wore sneakers because the controls were very, very light. And if they wore shoes, they couldn't feel the rudder bar real enough, so they wore tennis shoes. And I like this picture because, I don't know, I would like to have one time in my life have enough savoir-faire or whatever it takes to stand and pose like that for a photograph that's going to go on the front of every aviation magazine in the country, which is where it went. He won. And here are the results of the 1922 Pulitzer. The first two places were taken by R-6s, the airplanes we've just seen. The third and fourth place were taken by Curtiss CR-2s, which were the plane that Acosta had flown the year before, upgraded. It didn't have the Landon radiators anymore either. It had the wing or skin radiators. And then this assortment of other airplanes here. Now you're looking there and you're saying, where is the Wright airplane? Well, here's what happened to the Wright airplane. Sanderson was flying the Pulitzer, and on the first and second lap, the temperature gauge kept going up and up and up. By the time he started the third lap, he'd taken a hanky out of his pocket and put it over the instrument panel so he couldn't see the gauge. If you listen to click and clack, this sounds like something they would do, you know? But as he began the eastbound leg on the third lap across Lake St. Clair, the whole airplane was getting hot, and he looked back and there was this, should be an S there, sorry, and onshore. The person who puts my PowerPoints together isn't very good sometimes. I have to get on myself. But anyway, and I've gone back three times to correct handy to hanky, but I haven't done that yet. Anyway, he couldn't ignore the fact the airplane was really hot. He couldn't ignore the fact that steam and smoke was streaming behind him. And he couldn't ignore the fact that he would never make it across Lake St. Clair. So he turned back to go to shore. And he came to shore, and it was teeming with spectators who had no idea in the world what he was doing. He was supposed to go here, make a left turn, and go that way. Now he was coming back. And they didn't run away. They didn't know they were supposed to run away. So he couldn't land on shore, so he ditched the airplane in Lake St. Clair. And remember the picture of the Wright airplane? It had this enormous landing gear. When that hit the water, the plane turned turtle, and it catapulted Lieutenant Sanderson out of the cockpit, head down into this muck on the bottom of Lake St. Clair. And he finally got himself out of the mud, and he rinsed himself off, and he walked ashore. He was uninjured. I didn't mention this, but he also flew in the Curtiss Marine Trophy race, which I didn't talk about. And he would have won that race, but he ran out of gas and landed in the river in sight of the finish line. So he had a bad week at Detroit. Now I get to the most successful air meet in the history of the United States. And it was flown in St. Louis in 1923. And one of the principal reasons for its success was Listerine. Albert Bond Lambert's father was a co-inventor or formulator of Listerine. And Listerine was originally marketed to dentists as a prescription drug for use in dental practice. It was also marketed as a cure for gonorrhea. I don't know whether it was ingested orally or used some other way. I don't know. And I don't know how successful it was. It was very successful as a floor cleaner. Okay? But the people at Lambert were smart people, and they diluted it. And they started selling it over the counter as a mouthwash. And they invented a disease that it could cure. And some of you are old enough to remember halitosis. Sounds a lot worse than bad breath, doesn't it? Yes, indeed. And they made a fortune with ads about this woman, Edna, who was always a bridesmaid and never a bride because she had bad breath, halitosis. And nobody told her, and if they'd only told her, she'd use Listerine and her bad breath had gone away and she'd have been married many times over, evidently. But she couldn't get a job. She couldn't get the acting position she wanted. But Lambert made a lot of money. Lambert was also very interested in aviation. He was a balloon pilot and an airplane pilot. And in 1922, he bought this enormous tract of land north of St. Louis and gave it to the city and said, build an airport. And And, you know, if you ever have a bond issue and you can pay me back, fine. And they did. They finally paid me back. No interest, no carrying charge. But Lambert both gave them the land. And if you land at the airport in St. Louis now, it's the Lambert International Airport. And Lambert was very instrumental in bringing the 1923 National Air Race, including the Pulitzer race, to St. Louis. And the Navy purchased four new racers, two Wrights and two Curtises. And the Army purchased no new racers. They just flew their R6s, which had won in 1923, or 22. Here's the Navy R2C. Again, there's no radiator. It's a very smooth, very small airplane. And the big innovation in 1923 was the upper wing, which had always sat on struts above the fuselage, was now brought down flush with the fuselage, and it got rid of a lot of air turbulence and speeded up the airplane. And the pilot, sitting back here, then looked out over the wing when he was flying the airplane. The Wrights built a conventional-looking biplane this year. No more of that sesquiplane stuff. And this, I think, is a remarkable photograph. This was 20 years after Kitty Hawk. One of the two people important at Kitty Hawk was Orville Wright. And here he is with this airplane. It's the innovation and changes in aviation in 20 years are just mind-boggling to look at this. And this is Lieutenant Sandy Sanderson, who would fly the Wright F2W in the 1923 race. Again, the Wright airplane is bigger than the Curtiss airplane, has a much more powerful engine than the Curtiss airplane. This is an oil cooler, by the way, this thing that sticks up here. And it has surface radiators. You can see on this photograph, you can see these lines on the lower part of the wings. That's where the channels for the water to run back, the front and back on the wings for the radiator. The Wright airplane had a very high compression engine. And high compression engines in those days were started by a gang of men, two or three or four or five men, holding hands, one of them grabbing the propeller, and then they'd all run and pull and try to start the engine. It's like starting a huge motor, lawnmower engine. So this part of the picture is easy to understand. Well, these three guys are pulling the propeller to start the engine. There's somebody sitting in the cockpit to modulate the controls. I have no idea who these people are or what they're doing. But when you go to the National Archives and look at photographs, you do come across some dandies. Here's a lineup of the two Wright racers, which are down here. They're painted bright red. Again, you can see the surface, the wing radiators, the striations for the radiators, which are on all these airplanes. They're painted red with white wings. The Curtiss planes were painted blue-gray, because they're built for the Navy. When I look at this photograph, the Curtiss airplanes look like greyhounds. I mean, they look like they're built for speed. They're built, they're small. The Wright airplanes are not that much bigger, but they look like draft horses somehow compared to the Curtiss, at least in my eyes. And the result is what you'd expect. The Curtiss airplanes placed first and second. And third, Lieutenant Sandy Sanderson. Remember, he ran out of gas at the Marine Trophy race. He crashed at the Lake St. Clair in the 1922 Pulitzer. But he finished third in the 1923 Pulitzer. After he crossed the finish line, he zoomed up, as race pilots do, to spill off their speed. They zoomed up, and he ran out of gas again. And because they'd fitted the air... They had fitted it with a very small gas tank to keep the weight down, and it was just a few ounces short. And he zoomed up, he came down really hard, he crashed off the airfield behind a little hill. It was an enormous cloud of dust. And when people got there to rescue him, he had a sprained ankle. So I don't know. His 11 months of air racing, or 13 months of air racing with two crashes and running out of gas the third time, it's just remarkable. Oh, well. And the other Wright plane placed fourth, and the old Curtiss R6s, which had been left over from 1922, place fifth and sixth. And now I'm going to go really fast because I'm running out of time. When I volunteered at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, and when I first went there, I heard these stories, which were almost urban folk tales, that the wind coming over the windshield of the Curtiss racers would cut a groove in the helmets of the pilots. Well, it's no urban myth. This is from the National Archives again, and you can see where the wind is just cut right through the leather and partially into the wool lining of Al Williams's flying cap. Williams is the winner of the 1923 Pulitzer race. He was a Navy pilot. He's being congratulated by General Mason Patrick, who was the head of the Army Air Service. So after the Pulitzer races, Williams flew the R2C in straight line flight and set absolute land plane speed record, fastest land plane in the world. Even more gratifying to American aviation in 1923 was that the Navy took its R2Cs, which were in reality the RC that had been built for the 1920 race and then been modified for the 1921 race. Had been built for the 1921 race and modified for the 1922 race, mainly getting rid of the Lamblin radiators. And they put it on floats. They put both of them on floats. They took them to England and entered in the Schneider Trophy race, and they ran away with it. They won by about 40 miles an hour. So the United States had won the most prestigious international air race in 1923. And a few days later, one of the RC-3s set an absolute speed record for seaplanes. So in 1 year, we had the fastest land plane, the fastest seaplane, and we won the most prestigious international air race. Things could not have been better for American aviation probably than in 1923. Here's a chapter of my book about the 1924 race. Dayton, disappointment, and death. And the air race was held in Dayton, Ohio, at the Wright Airfield, which is part of the big Wright-Patterson Airfield complex now. And it was won by a monoplane, which was built from the 1922 race. There were no new racers in 1924. It flew 28 miles per hour slower than the airplane that won in 1923, a year earlier. So a very disappointing result. Attendance was miserable. A 500,000 people had been at the St. Louis Air Meet. Dayton originally expected 250,000 people to show up. They backed off to 200,000. And in reality, maybe 75,000 people showed up. And worst of all, an Army pilot died in diving across the start line to start the Pulitzer. So it was a terrible, terrible blow to people interested in air racing, people interested in aviation in general. I'll show you a picture. This is the airplane that won in 1924. Here's the pilot, Lieutenant Harry Mills. And he's wearing boots. He's not wearing tennis shoes. I don't know how that happened. Yeah, this airplane was not built by Curtiss, but it had a Curtiss engine, and it had the wing radiators, which had also been patented by Curtiss. And it had retractable landing gear. So this airplane, despite being really slow as compared to the Curtiss airplanes, was a picture of the future. Low wing, streamlined monoplane with retractable landing gear. Okay. The National Aeronautic Association, which sanctions air meets in this country and certifies records, and was very worried about the success of the 1925 Pulitzer. They were so worried, they said, we won't put this one out for bids. We won't give it to a city to conduct. We'll do it ourselves from our New York offices, where we can depend on our close contacts with ad agencies. We'll generate a lot of interest in the race, and we'll get 500,000 people to attend the air races. The Army bought, Mike, the Army bought one new racer, and the Navy bought two. There was a total of three, not four. Anyway, and they also scheduled the air races for early October to avoid bad weather. And I think things probably went wrong from the start. This is a postcard sent out to advertise the Pulitzer Trophy race, 1925. Saturday, October the 10th. And here's a picture of an airplane. It's not a picture of a Wright racer. It's not a picture of a Curtis racer. It's not a picture of a Verville racer. It's a picture of a de Havilland DH-4, which is an airplane built as a bombing airplane in World War I by the British. What in the world, whatever prompted them to put this on a postcard advertising a speed race is beyond me. And I think it's an example of how things went wrong in 1925. Things just didn't click. Worse, the weather. The race was scheduled Thursday, Friday, Saturday. Thursday is okay. A lot of preliminary races were flown successfully. On Friday, one race was flown. Then the wind came up. The wind came up and it was blowing the airplanes across the field. And it also, women in long skirts, which were also blown across the airfield. So they canceled the flights on Friday. They didn't even try on Saturday. There were snow flurries, 70 mile per hour winds, and almost steady rain. Sunday morning was bad. Sunday afternoon was okay, but there were no scheduled flights. But it was okay, because the Pulitzer had been rescheduled from Saturday, which is a holiday from work for most people, to Monday, October 12th, which is Columbus Day, which is a holiday, so it should be good for attendance. The race was flown, the Pulitzer was flown on Monday, October the 12th, and the next day, this was the headline in the New York Times. Pulitzer race won at 249 miles speed, disappoints flyers. You talk about a downer of a headline. You know, you have to go a distance to find one that's better than that. And they disappointed flyers, but they didn't disappoint many spectators, because maybe 25,000 people saw the Pulitzer. 45,000 people in all came to the 1925 National Air Race, less than a tenth of what the National Aeronautic Association expected. This is a terrible picture. I apologize for it, and I'll skip it. This is not a good picture either, it turns out. But this is the man who won the 1925 race. His name is Cyrus or Cy Bettis, who was an Army lieutenant. And there are a lot of pictures of Bettis, and almost always he has a hangdog expression. He does not have a hangdog expression here. He's very happy because he's won the race. This is Al Williams, a man who won in 1923. Williams was a remarkable man, an excellent pilot. He had pitched for the New York Giants before World War I. He earned a law degree at Georgetown University when he was serving in the Navy. He resigned from the Navy in the 1930s because he was angry at how slowly we were rearming in anticipation of a war. And he became a publicist for aviation. He wrote everywhere. He had a weekly column in a lot of newspapers. He wrote about aviation. He's a remarkable man. And his temperament is often described as acerbic, which I'm not quite sure what it means, but I think it means a person you don't want to be around too often. Anyway, when he finished the Pulitzer race in 1925, he knew he was second. He knew that Bettis had won, and he sat in his airplane and refused to get up and go congratulate Bettis. So his friends came down and said, "Come on, Al, go over there." His sister came, "Come on, Al, go over there." So he finally went over and congratulated Bettis. But despite all his accomplishments, the fact that he was a poor sport and didn't congratulate Bettis as he should have, it's just this black mark that hangs over him. And when you read about Al Williams, there are people who praise him without stint. And other people praise him without stint, and then they say, but he's a poor loser. Remember? So anyway, nobody knew it in 1925, but this was the end of the Pulitzer races. There would be no more Pulitzer races. But there was another glorious moment in American aviation history. 2 weeks after Bettis won the Pulitzer race on Long Island, Jimmy Doolittle, the General Jimmy Doolittle, later led the raid on Tokyo in 1942, flew the R-2C, now equipped with floats and flown as a seaplane, to win the Schneider race at Baltimore. And the day after that, he set an absolute speed record for seaplanes. So the airplane was successful. It won the Pulitzer race and the Schneider race. This is not, by the way, the airplane that Doolittle flew. This is one of the Navy R-3Cs. But the Pulitzers ended in 1925, and that brings me to I left a slide out here, but I wanted to summarize what I think the Pulitzer's accomplished. The Pulitzer's accomplished everything their sponsors wanted. It aroused a great deal of aviation in this country for a short period of time. It developed engines and airframes that found markets domestically and, more importantly, foreign. When Curtiss sold V-12 engines in England to England and Italy in 1923, it made the news in the New York Times. It's the first time an American company had sold an engine, an airplane engine, in Europe since 1910. So it was a remarkable breakthrough in American aviation. The American Pulitzer Racer has won 2 Schneider races, which is a great accomplishment. And I think they did everything they wanted to do. And I say that they interest me. I think they're terribly important. They're almost ignored. And I sat for a long time and wondered, why are they ignored? And I finally borrowed the last line from a poem, The Hollow Men, by T.S. Eliot, which was written in 1925, the same year as the last Pulitzer. The Pulitzers didn't have an ending. There was no trophy at the end awarded to the winner for 3 races, which had been the case with the Gordon Bennetts and the Schneiders. They just ended. And a lackluster performance, disappointing speeds, nobody cared. Nobody came to the race. The government was no longer interested in air racing because they decided they could develop high-speed planes without the expense and the bother of holding air races. And I think the reason we ignore the Pulitzers is, like T.S. Eliot said about far more serious things, this is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. And the Pulitzers really did end with a whimper. On September 1, 1926, almost a year later, there's this announcement, this is a whole article in the New York Times, no Pulitzer race this year. And then there's this wonderful sentence here. A principal reason was the lack of entrants. I don't think you need another reason. That was it. And they disappeared from view. Oh, here's my signature. That's why I couldn't find it before. We'll skip that. Now, if there is one great artifact left from the Pulitzer races, this is the Curtiss R3C2, which is, as it was flown by Jimmy Doolittle at the Schneider race. It's at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington in a room called the Pioneers of Flight. And you can go there and walk around and look. To my mind, it's a very interesting airplane. Of course, it would be, to my mind. It won the Pulitzer in 1925, and it won the Schneider in 1925. It also flew in the Schneider race in 1926 and placed second to an Italian plane. In the same room as the Pioneers of Flight, the Pulitzer Trophy is there. It's 4 feet, 4 inches high, sterling silver. It's shiny. And whereas you have to go to Washington to see the R2C2, you can buy my book. And on the cover is a Pulitzer Trophy. So you can save yourself a trip. And thank you very much for coming. I hope you had some enjoyment and learned something.